ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him because he was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
John was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
According to the United Nations Environment Programme, somewhere between 19 and 23 million tonnes of plastic finds its way into waterways and other aquatic environments every year. Then there's the stuff that ends up in our forests and backyards, the atmosphere, and in our bodies. Plastic, the wonder material of the 20th century, has now become one of the greatest environmental and human health threats of the 21st. On today's edition of Future Tense on ABC Radio National, we'll get an update on just how well we're tackling the issue. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. We'll also get details on the latest efforts to try and decarbonise the cement production sector. And then, changing tack, we'll talk about AI chatbots and the increasing role they're playing as sources of advice and emotional support.
You know, what information might be comforting might actually be wrong. It might be misleading, or it could even lead to harmful advice. And that's really concerning to me as a clinical psychologist.
Microplastic pollution is a problem that knows no geographic boundary, on land or at sea. Traces of microplastics have been found right across the planet, even on the ocean floor. Now, efforts to negotiate a global plastics treaty recently stalled. So where to from here? Dr. Shababa Salim is a senior technology analyst with ID Tech X in the United Kingdom.
These are considered to be plastics that are around 5 millimetres in size or less. And you have two types of microplastics. So you have primary and secondary microplastics. So starting with secondary, these are generated from, you know, the breakdown of larger plastics in the environment. So here, mismanaged waste is a key contributor. But on the other hand, you have primary microplastics, and these are intentionally manufactured. So these are typically added as functional additives to various products. Now, in the EU, for example, an estimated 150,000 tons of microplastics are used, primary microplastics are used per year. And, you know, these are used across artificial sports surfaces, detergents, agricultural products, cosmetics, and several others. So, yeah, it's an environmental issue, but also during plastic manufacturing as well, you know, you have plastic pellets, for example. These are molded and extruded into plastic products. Now, production, shipment, and use of this is one of the largest contributors of microplastics in the environment as well, because, you know, these are very small, they're highly mobile, so mishandling can then lead to these being leaked into the environment.
Talks on a global plastics treaty stalled earlier this year. Does that set back the process of trying to deal with the levels of microplastics that are actually now in the environment and likely to enter the environment in future years?
Well, the global plastics treaty would help tackle plastic waste, but there are also talks about limiting plastic production or, you know, looking into setting minimum recycled content of plastics and products. So when it comes to tackling the source of microplastic pollution, which is ultimately plastic production and consumption, which then down the chain leads to plastic pollution, it is a setback for tackling plastic production.
And in terms of dealing with the microplastic pollution that's already out there in the environment, what are the main technologies, the most promising technologies that are on the market at the moment?
Currently, there isn't really anything that's deployed at scale to specifically target microplastics. But you have technologies that are in development. So these are mostly at early or exploratory stages. You can have physical processes like filtration, magnetic separation, or chemical processes like using adsorbents or coagulants. And there's also biological processes such as microbial breakdown or enzymatic breakdown to remove microplastics. Some of these can achieve high removal efficiencies. There is a startup in Spain called Captoplastic. Now, they're developing microplastic capture technology for aqueous systems, and they're using iron-based magnetic particles. These attract microplastics to form aggregates, which can then be manipulated by an external magnetic field. And then the magnetic particles are then regenerated and circulated in a continuous process. The company claims that the technology can remove up to 80% of microplastics, and then the iron particles that are used to capture the microplastics can, you know, be recovered up to 94% of those that are used in the process. However, as with most of the technologies that are in development right now, these have only been tested at small scale or pilot scale trials, and they need to be verified at larger scales to assess the viability and feasibility. And there are several other players that are developing technologies for capturing microplastics in laundry systems, for example, where you do have some regulations coming in, whether it be in Australia or France, to install capture systems at laundry facilities or washing machines. But for just large-scale capture for municipal facilities, for example, the technologies are really not quite there yet.
And is cost the real challenge there in terms of scaling up some of these technologies or potentially scaling up some of these technologies?
There are several challenges here, really. One of the main challenges is associated with the nature of the microplastics. So they're small and they're highly mobile. Their buoyancy may alter depending on their history. For example, it can change due to degradation, can change during fragmentation or biofouling. So it's very difficult to tackle something that is continually changing and so different in nature across the landscape. And most current filtration technologies are primarily effective for large particles and may fail to capture smaller particles or nanoplastics. And then you have additional challenges that arise from the variation in the removal efficiency based on the type, the size, the shape, the density of the microplastics. And of course, designing something that is effective is costly. So cost is a barrier, but to get an understanding of the cost, we do need to then look at these technologies progressing down, doing, you know, pilot tests to get an assessment or estimation of how effective they are, what the OPEX may be, what the CAPEX may be, but the technologies just haven't progressed to that scale yet to kind of determine those calculations.
Well, Dr. Shababa Salim, thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
Thank you very much, Anthony. It was lovely speaking to you.
A cleanup of a very different kind now. What to do about cement? It's a crucial building material and one that's hard to see the world doing without. But like most things associated with construction, it has a carbon problem, and a sizable one at that.
The emissions from cement is about, depends who you ask and exactly how you do the calculation, but it's about 7% of global CO2 emissions. It's a big chunk. It's not the biggest chunk, which is power generation, but it's something we need to seriously address.
That's Paul Fennell, a professor of clean energy at Imperial College London and an expert on carbon capture and storage.
In terms of processes where you actually have to have some form of CCS, it's non-controversial for cement production because you just can't get away without it. You start out with calcium carbonate and you change that to calcium oxide and CO2, and that's about roughly half of the CO2 emissions from cement production. So you just can't get away from the requirement to do CCS somehow.
But CCS is a technology, as we've heard many times on this program in the past, whose reality has never really met its promise. But is that beginning to change, at least where cement is concerned? Two European CCS ventures are now taking shape, one in Norway and one in Wales. Professor Fennell.
Projects that you've discussed, Padeswood and the Northern Lights project, the cement plant at Brevik in Norway, are significant. So this really demonstrates that CO2 capture is a mature technology. I mean, it's a solved problem for chemical engineering. What we do need to do is continue on development and driving down the price of this.
And what kind of difference could it make to the cement production industry?
Oh, you're talking about 7% of global CO2. So realistically, if you put CCS on every plant, you're talking about maybe 95% of that. Yeah, you can capture almost all of the CO2, and cement is uniquely susceptible to some form of carbon capture and storage because you can produce a very highly concentrated stream of CO2 if you do your chemical engineering correctly, and you can capture maybe half of the CO2 from cement manufacturing at a very modest price. So that's good.
And are the cement producers themselves, are they behind this technology? Do they see it as an inevitability?
I think they really do. Nobody really wants to add cost to their system, and they worry about whether or not they might be producing cement in a regulated area and face competition from non-regulated areas. So, you know, in, say, the EU context, people could produce cement in, say, Morocco and sell it into the EU market. And if a regulated area faces competition from a non-regulated area without some form of carbon border adjustment, which is essentially a tariff on bringing your cement into the area from somewhere where, you know, the CO2 emissions are not costed for, there can be some issues. But the cement industry as a whole is strongly caring about decarbonisation and is looking to all sorts of different technologies. I mean, this is not the only technology for cement decarbonisation, but it is a necessary technology for strong decarbonisation of cement.
Professor Paul Fennell from Imperial College London and attempts to clean up the global cement sector. And this is Future Tense on ABC Radio National. I'm Anthony Fennell. A very different topic now, as foreshadowed, and a recent YouGov research study found that 1 in 7 Australian adults could imagine falling in love with a chatbot. And if that isn't concerning enough, psychologists are now warning that people are increasingly turning to artificial intelligence for medical help. Professor Jill Newby is with the Black Dog Institute at the University of New South Wales, which specialises in matters of depression and mental health. Professor Newby says the trend is both concerning and complicated.
We're hearing at the Black Dog Institute that a lot more people, more than ever, are turning to AI for medical advice and mental health advice. Mental health is one of the top three reasons why people turn to ChatGPT. And what can be concerning about that is the way the information is presented. You can't actually assess how high quality the information is or how accurate it is, but it is presented in a way that's very convincing, very supportive, very normalizing, which can feel very comforting to a person. But you know, what information might be comforting might actually be wrong. It might be misleading, or it could even lead to harmful advice. And that's really concerning to me as a clinical psychologist.
In terms of motivation, how much is the cost of mental health care an issue here?
It's the availability or lack of availability of mental health care that's probably one of the reasons why people turn to mental health information online. We know that it can be really hard to get into GPs for mental health support. It can be hard to access psychology, psychiatry, and other mental health supports in the community. And particular areas of the country, you know, rural, remote, and regional areas are even more difficult to access mental health support. So that's one of the reasons why people would turn to AI or social media or online health information. But the other reason is it's private. You know, sometimes we're embarrassed to ask the questions that we have around mental health from the people that we know or even health professionals. And you can turn to the internet and ask the most embarrassing questions you've ever had and not be judged and not worry about judgment when you ask those questions. And that can be quite comforting, but also private. The other thing is the availability and the time when that information is available to people. You might be starting to worry about your mental health in the middle of the night and have insomnia and experience symptoms that you're not sure what they mean. And it's quite difficult to access a mental health professional at that time. You know, you could call Lifeline or another mental health support or counselling line, but you could also just Google it on your phone. And that can be a lot easier for people at certain times of day.
What kind of questions are being asked online from your experience?
All sorts of questions. It could be anything from, I'm having a fight with my partner, who's right or wrong. It can be, I'm experiencing this symptom, how can I manage it? How can I be less lonely and better connect with my friends? All the way to more kind of extreme examples. So it can really be any reason why people turn to AI. It can also be for companionship. You know, we've heard of a lot of people asking about quite complex, big questions and thoughtful questions to AI because that is at their fingertips and kind of available like a companion. So that can be a really good thing for some people, but the downside is that we just don't know how accurate the information is, and it is like a friend, but a health professional isn't necessarily like that. When you're a health professional and you have a client in front of you or a patient, you want to ask them about their whole history, ask them really in-depth questions about what's going on to understand their context and their family and their background and the symptoms they're experiencing. And you don't always agree with everything that the client says, because sometimes it's the behaviours or the strategies that they're using are actually harmful or not helpful. And so part of your job as a health professional is to help support the client and work together to find more healthy or helpful strategies. And AI doesn't do that. It just agrees with you.
Is there a risk that the lines between real mental health conditions and normal stresses of life get blurred with the way in which we search online for medical advice? The kinds of language, psychological language, that used to be professional but now is just everyday.
There is a blurring of the lines between what is a clinical or diagnosable mental disorder versus what's a normal everyday experience. Terms like trauma, narcissism, anxiety, depression, they're all quite commonly used now. And maybe one easy example is anxiety. Everyone experiences anxiety. It's actually quite normal. It's helpful. It's sometimes very useful to worry about things and to feel a bit anxious because it helps us prepare for threat and keeps us out of danger. It helps us be alert to situations where we might be threatened or need to prepare for keeping ourselves safe. But that's very different to an anxiety disorder, which has a number of symptoms. The anxiety that a person experiences needs to occur quite frequently over a long period of time and have a debilitating nature that impacts their social life, their work, their functioning, and their everyday activities. So that the term anxiety is used a lot, even though it's very different to an anxiety disorder. The same thing we see with trauma. You know, you could use the words, well, I was really traumatized by that movie I saw on the weekend. And that kind of language, I guess, normalizes an experience that's very different to someone having post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a real clinical condition that occurs after someone has experienced a life-threatening or traumatic event and has a range of different symptoms. So I think it just blurs the line between normal everyday experiences versus what's actually quite debilitating for a lot of people, and that can be a bit of a problem.
So is there a danger in overusing the terms that we actually get an incorrect idea about the mental state of society itself?
Well, we can, yeah. If we're using these terms a lot, we can kind of assume that these conditions are a lot more prevalent than they are. We know, for example, depression or major depression, which is a particular type of mental health condition, affects around 1 in 7 individuals, which is quite a lot of people, but it also means, you know, 6 in 7 individuals don't experience that kind of depression. So when we use those terms, it does kind of inflate the sense that the general population is experiencing this. And that can also feel quite anxiety provoking and overwhelming because it can make people feel like the world is in really dire straits and that no one is well, no one is mentally healthy, no one's coping. And that can be quite worrying for a lot of people.
Jill Newby from the Black Dog Institute at the University of New South Wales. Now, somebody who's also interested in the way people are using AI chatbots for advice is Pratik Sachdeva, a research scientist at the University of California, Berkeley. Pratik's focus has been on the nature of the advice AI programs are giving to people, specifically where issues of emotion and or morality are involved.
The usage of chatbots and large language models for just general advice is definitely increasing over time. In the last few weeks, both OpenAI and Anthropic have released their own reports on how their users are using these tools. And there are some pretty salient findings there. For example, OpenAI, about 70% of its traffic is actually about practical guidance. That's like the biggest category. And that can be a lot of different things, but that's pretty notable in that it's not simply just coding or just work, which is what these tools were kind of initially used for when they first came out. I think the last 10 years, like one of the major stories is this is an age of the attention economy. This is an age of engagement. And so you take this tool, which is as hard as I try not to anthropomorphize them, you have a conversation with this tool and it often sounds like a very understanding human. It's sometimes it's hard to disentangle these things. You have a tool that's infinitely available, never gets impatient, and it's at least at face value seems to be empathetic. It seems to listen to you and acknowledge your feelings. So from that perspective, with the fact that these tools are designed to be highly engaging and they're quite good at it, it's kind of unsurprising that people are increasingly using them to ask about personal or emotional dilemmas. You couple that with increasing research on the loneliness epidemic, and it kind of all falls into place.
What are the risks, as you see them, in relying on AI for this kind of purpose?
I think there's several. First of all, there is, of course, the issue of hallucinations, which has been well studied. These models can be very confident in asserting incorrect or wrong answers. That becomes a little bit tricky to frame when we're talking about personal or emotional dilemmas, where we might call them no consensus scenarios, where a person may reasonably argue for one perspective or the other. But because these tools so confidently give you an answer, that may remove some of the nuance from these emotional or personal dilemmas. The other issue is that of alignment. And this is a topic that's been well studied as well. These models don't just come out of the box having certain values. These values have to be trained into them through what's called alignment processes. So the big companies spend a lot of money and a lot of effort trying to steer these models to be really helpful. They try to steer them to be honest, and they try to steer them to be harmless. But as they do that, these models pick up different values, and these values can reflect the perspectives of these companies. Those values are then elicited during these conversations when you ask them about a personal or emotional dilemma. And so if we as a population don't fully understand what values can you elicit from these models, what values are they representing, then that's going to shape what values humans believe and how humans act, and maybe in ways that we don't expect or want to have more control over depending on what those values are.
And it's very hard to know what those values are, given that these chatbots are proprietary in nature, that companies own them and those companies are competing with each other, so are not likely to give over the way in which they work.
Exactly. All of these processes are proprietary in nature. But even if we did have access to all of them, these models are deeply hard to understand. They're massive, and probing them has been a really challenging research problem. So being able to say definitively, oh, this model espouses this value, or this model espouses that value, it's not that simple. The values that may be elicited could differ from conversation to conversation. They could differ based off of context. They could differ based off the version number of the model you're using. They could differ based off of your past conversations with these models. So it's been really challenging and research trying to identify and salient trends that we can say about what values these models are eliciting, even if we had access to all of these proprietary knowledge pipelines.
Tell us about the research that you've personally done looking at chatbots and how their advice can differ from human advice.
So in the spirit of what I just talked about in terms of trying to understand what values you can elicit from these models, what kinds of norms they espouse, a lot of work has tried to do that initially when ChatGPT first came out, has tried to do that by prompting these models with surveys or very simple scenarios. For example, the political compass test is a well-known survey that humans can take to try and say something about what their political leanings are. So you're asked a bunch of questions, you give a bunch of responses, and then using those responses, you say something about the values there. So people did this with these LLMs. They prompted them with different surveys and they looked at what the responses were and said something about the values. But what my colleague, Tom Van Noonen, and I really wanted to understand is that these models are not prompted with surveys. When humans are engaging with them, they're asking them about complex, unstructured, really messy scenarios. And it's not clear that the findings from simple surveys or very simple vignettes is going to translate to really messy dilemmas when there's all these extraneous information where tone matters. Those things may shape the model's output. So our perspective was, let's use everyday dilemmas in order to understand what values and what norms we can elicit from large language models. There's a social media platform called Reddit. Reddit is basically a very large and well-known social media platform divided into very niche communities. And one of those communities on Reddit is called Am I the Asshole, where people come to the social media platform, they pose a dilemma, and they ask the community to judge them, whether they were the asshole or not the asshole. And we saw this and thought that this was a really good test case, because these are the rich, complex, everyday dilemmas that was missing in the literature. At the same time, we had user responses to those dilemmas. So we could compare what users, what real humans responded to these dilemmas to what large language models would respond to them and make apt comparisons about human values and about the values you can elicit from large language models. So we took 10,000 everyday dilemmas from Reddit's Am I the Asshole community. We prompted 7 different large language models to assign blame in those dilemmas. We also asked the models to explain their reasoning and say something about what kinds of themes were present.
And what were your findings?
Our findings were pretty striking in that we found, on a dilemma-by-dilemma basis, models could give pretty strikingly different verdicts. In general, agreement between these models was very low, and they were also very low with the human responses, with the Redditors, which is pretty striking because a human may take this dilemma to any one of these models and ask for feedback, and who knows what kind of response they'll get. It may vary, which will then shape what that human thinks of themselves in the dilemma and how they might act.
So there's a real caution there, isn't there, about using these AI models for advice on very emotional, very difficult issues?
Yeah, I think we really, as humans, need to think about, if I'm using this model to ask for feedback, understanding and contextualizing the model's role and not giving it too much weight. Just treating it as one possible perspective, but not losing the human element. We go to our friends, we go to our family, we go to mentors for feedback on these kinds of personal and everyday dilemmas. We should not lose that human element when we're increasingly using these models to ask for feedback on these everyday dilemmas. And in particular, we should take these models with a grain of salt because they are trained to increase engagement. They do exhibit sycophancy, where they are more likely to appeal to our sense of face. And so that's going to shape what kinds of responses they give, especially when it comes to assigning blame.
Well, Pratik Sachdeva, thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
Really appreciate it. This is a lot of fun. Thank you.
And that's our program for another week. Future Tense is an ABC Radio National production. The producer is Karin Zsivanovits. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.